Well, welcome again. Boy, not only the snow, but plenty of sickness around here, right? Anybody been in the throes of the flu in the last couple weeks? Has anyone come out on the other side? I mean, it's brutal. If it's hit you, we're sorry. We hope and trust you're well. I'm especially mindful this week of a good friend of mine. Many of you know Brian Appel as well. Brian and I and his wife Courtney went to high school together. I officiated their wedding. I baptized both of their children. And Brian had open heart surgery this week, pretty unexpectedly. Actually was told at the beginning of this week that he was not a candidate for surgery. No one was going to operate on him. No one would touch him. And was essentially given maybe weeks to months to live. And then kind of out of the blue, a Hail Mary pass was thrown, and a surgeon was found right here in Grand Rapids who was willing to do the surgery. And so in like less than 48 hours, it went from not having much hope to having at least the possibility of more life. And Brian came through that surgery, I think, in ways that blew people's minds and no one really expected and thought. He's still in the hospital, still dealing with the pain of having your chest, broken open. But he's alive, and Brian and Courtney and their family were part of the branch in the early years. Brian was actually one of our first deacons, and they're here today. There they are. There's Courtney, and Ryan and Evie, and we're so glad that you're here today. And we're so glad that we get to hug you with smiles on our faces today. I know you are. So thank God for that gift upon gift upon gift. We share it with you with great joy. All right, we have the privilege of welcoming Yaakov. That's why there's another stool. It's not like, hey, who's the ghost guest? Yaakov is gonna join us this morning because what we're trying to do here these last few weeks is better know, as Nate was praying, for our family. The other churches that meet in this building, we've worshiped together. We pass CCGR in the hallway. We don't pass the Nepali church in the hallway because they worship Sunday afternoon. And so we don't really see them much. But, we've taken a couple of steps to get to know each other. But really, we're in the infancy of that. And so I said to Rodrigo and Yaakov, would you guys come on separate weeks just so that we can hear about your congregation, so that more steps can be taken to deepen the level of relationship and trust between our congregations. And so would you join me in welcoming Yaakov up here this morning? Come on up, buddy. Glad to have you, friend. Yeah. Well, I hope there. Yeah, I mean, you can sit somewhere else if you want to, but that would be great. Yaakov and I got to room together last week when we were in New Jersey, and you learn things about people when you share a hotel room together. Like, wow, as he learned about me, that guy snores at night. Or is that person a night owl, or are they an early riser? And the gift of being in New Jersey was manyfold, I think, to have you, Rodrigo, and I together fly in the same plane, sit next to each other, eat meals. We got to hear each other's stories, at least part of them. And that was a gift. And I'm grateful for Yaakov. I always have been, but the more I know him, the more grateful I am for who he is and his generous, kind, open heart. And so it's a joy to have you here today, man. Glad to have you.
And thank you so much for inviting me here and to speak again. I'm really privileged. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We're honored. We're going to dive right in. Part of the reason why part of the hope of this morning is that you all would better know the Nepali-speaking community church, that you would have a better sense of who they are. And so why don't you start by telling us a little bit about who your people are and take that wherever you want to take it. Tell us about your congregation.
We are Nepali-speaking congregation, and mostly refugees from Bhutan, but ethnically we are all Nepali. We speak Nepali language. I don't know how many years, but 100, 200 years ago, some of our forefathers, they moved from Nepal to Bhutan for the sake of work or some other thing, and eventually they outgrew in that country. They dominated the country in such a way that actually all of the Bhutanese people, they speak Nepali now. And then there was some kind of political, but I would also say some cultural conflict within the country. And then there was revolt from Nepali-speaking community in Bhutan, because Bhutan is still under the king. So king is ruling, so they were asking democracy and all those things. And also there was some other cultural impose that government was imposing upon everyone, which Nepali people did not accept easily. For example, Bhutan government would ask to put on a uniform for everyone, like wherever they go. So Nepali people would not, especially in government offices or in the school or any other offices, Nepali people would not agree that. So there was some kind of rift, some kind of conflict, and then that argued. And that's and then in 1992, Bhutan government kind of excommunicated or kicked them.
Kicked them out
from the
okay.
country. That's how they came to Nepal, and they came to United States in 2008. And then that's how we actually I got to know people here. About our people, about our church, we actually started in 2012, October 2nd week, as a informal congregation or fellowship.
Yeah, you were living here and noticing that there were more Nepali people around, and you thought, well, we should maybe gather these people together. Let's get together in somebody's house, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, prior to that, we were five family from Nepal. There are two group of Nepali speaking here in Grand Rapids or all over the United States. One is Nepali from Nepal. They were born and brought up in Nepal and came to the United States, and I'm one of them actually. And one group is people who were born in Bhutan,
okay.
came to Nepal, stayed as a refugee for 20 years. Some of the younger kids, they were born in Nepal, but Nepal government did not give them citizenship, so they were always refugees. So there are two group of people, Nepali from Nepal and Nepali from Bhutan.
Okay.
They came here. So okay. me and my, there were other five families. We were Nepali from Nepal, and we were theologically trained. And we were older in our faith, like Christian faith. And then we said, when I came here, there was no Nepali church, specifically for Nepali people. So we said, okay, we used to go to different English churches. So we said, I think we should meet once in a while and just pray. You know, we speak Nepali. Even though we eat pizza, but our stomach is never full. You know, we always want to have some rice. And that's how we feel. You know? So we said, we go to an English church. We know, we understand the English. But we feel never kind of satisfied somewhere deep down. So let's have some kind of fellowship or get together. So we did that for 6 months, rotating each of our houses every week. And then after 6 months, we said, I think there are so many Nepali speaking. Some of them are Christians already. We should invite them as well. That's how we started out.
Yeah, that's how your church started, yeah. By eating rice and meeting in people's homes. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. You came here to the States to go to school, right? You came to go to Calvin Theological Seminary, where you have two master's degrees, so I don't know how you do that. I barely made it through one, and I'm an English speaker, and so I really marvel at your commitment and your intellect. That's how you got here, right? Everybody else has come, most everyone else has come because of being a refugee, not through the educational pathway, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say even 98% of our congregations are refugees from Bhutan. And actually, it is tougher. It's been complete two years that I've been involving among our people. And more I listen to their stories, more I am grateful for what God has been doing. And also sometimes it gives me such a deep compassion. The reason is that the way they have gone through this process is actually beyond our imagination. Sometimes we talk about waiting things and all those things, you know, process. But they, when I listen to their stories, they have gone through all kind of whatever, you know, we can imagine, process they go through. I when I was in Kathmandu, I was teaching with one of our Bhutanese friends in Kathmandu Bible College. His brother actually got involved in politics, and because of that, he and his family wasn't allowed to come here, so they chose Denmark. So that is the process, you know. I mean, if there is any connection, like military, any connection the U.S. government finds, even the whole family sometimes is cut off.
You're not allowed to come to the United States.
That is the process. Not on top of that, they have to go through all kind of fingerprints, background check, and then they will not just examine their particular family, but entire their relatives, brother and sisters. If there is any connection with outside anything, all kind of process.
Not going to come through. Yeah. So, I think some of our people have been learning about the enormity of the refugee process, and this is what you're saying, right? Like, it is a huge process, many, many steps. And if you're coming to the United States, even if you have a cousin who was connected to the government or was politically kind of a dissident, you're not going to get into the United States, right?
Most of the time, U.S. government is very careful to look what is the connection between these two.
Yep.
If there is any connection, most likely, if there is political connection, they will say government will say no.
They're going to get in.
No.
Yeah.
That's how my friend ended up in Denmark.
In Denmark. So most of your people, 80 to 90%, are refugees from Bhutan, right? What is life like in a refugee camp?
I think it is hard, and also it is joyful. That's what I hear both from my friends. It is hard because they were supposed to live within the camp. Nepal government did not provide much benefits, and also a small hut. The small huts were attached to each other. They would say there was no room, actually, you know. I mean, there was no privacy at all. House from this house, people from this house to their house could listen and talk, you know. So houses were made of bamboos, They could literally see what's happening in the next house. So some people, they build their own things inside to protect their privacy. But most of the time, they would say it is so attached. And every year, it's a funny thing, but every year, houses get fired, you know? And once one house gets fired,
they all catch on fire.
Catch the fire. So we used to read that report every year when I was in Nepal, every year. So that's how they lived, not just a house, but also like flood and all those things. The good thing is that my people always tell me that they had a community. They could enter anyone's house easily, even though they didn't have privacy. They were always like noise and all this. But the good thing is that they were in such a community that they could enter anyone's house. I mean, they never felt alone. They could go anyone's house and just make fun and, you know.
Yeah. So it's both in the refugee camp. The community being a gift, right? This close-knit connection of people. So then what is it like to come to Grand Rapids, to get off the plane, to potentially know no one, and to have to start life all over, now disconnected from that community? What is life like when you step off the airplane here?
I think that is, it is just what I said, opposite of less community. That's what many people feel. And just 3 days ago, I was visiting a family that just newly arrived here. She was mentioning the same thing to me. She said she was so scared that I may not see anyone here. So when we went there, so she said, oh, luckily there is someone here. People are around here.
Yeah.
Even though she had her daughter, she still feels that she's out of the community.
Alone, yeah.
Alone, here. So that is the biggest thing. Many of our people, they feel that they might be alone. They don't know, especially language barrier is there. And people are different. Food is different.
Everything is different.
Work is different. Mm-hmm. We never work the way we work right now here. So everything is different. So I think that's a difficult part. Once they arrive here, they always feel, where am I?
Yeah, where am I? Mm. What's my place?
What's my place? What am I going to do? It is
daunting, I think, overwhelming, paralyzing sometimes. And I think as some of our people have started to work with refugees, this is what we hear over and over, is that sense of isolation and being alone, right? Even though there are how many Nepali refugees in the Grand Rapids area? What's the number, roughly?
This is our estimate.
Your estimate, okay.
This is not government official estimation. We say there are about 2,500 Nepali-speaking people, mostly in Kentwood area.
In Kentwood.
They are living more and more closer to that area.
They're getting back to the bamboo hut, right? Yeah, hey, many people will live in one home, or right, they'll squeeze into, So 2,500, is that what you said? That's your estimate?
That's what we believe.
Did you have any idea that there were 2,500 Nepali folks here, a couple miles that way? I mean, it's really amazing. So your church has been obviously a place in which community has been able to form and connect. I mean, I remember when you guys first came to this building about 3 years ago. You had people driving from Lansing, Grand Haven, I would hear about, all over West Michigan because of that connection. They were going to English services at churches, where they lived, but then they drive here in the afternoon or in the evening to just try and be with people, be in community.
Hmm. Yeah. They still come, not every week, but especially at Christmas. So especially at Christmas, people still drive here and they have worship. We have good relationship with people from Grand Haven. But now they're having their own fellowship. So we don't go. We used to go every week before and provide them some kind of fellowship. Even though it is snowing, we used to go. But now we stop that because they're having their own fellowship now. So we meet sometimes.
And Lansing too, right? Lansing has its own kind of community forming.
Lansing has, we actually, Nepali Church partner with another church. And we supervise that church. So they have their own community right now.
Yeah.
So we meet as leaders from Lansing Church, and as our leaders, we meet time to time.
That's great. That's a snapshot, right, of what life is like. A lot of your people work a lot. This is a very common story among refugees in general, but they work a lot because they often work in jobs that are not high paying, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I think I could say many things about how our people are living here. And you rightly put it out, one aspect is their work, their job, and its impact to their family. That's what I have been saying again and again and again. Many of our people, they don't speak English, even though they speak, but very limited, and also less skills or education. That means we all are supposed to, or kind of forced to do entry kind of level job in the factory, in the companies. That means less payment, less pay, and then overwork. That houses, the rent, and utility, and all those are up. But compared to that, the amount they are getting is so less. So many of our people, they work. 60 hours is not more, I think. There are people, they said to me sometimes, they have worked 72 hours straight. 72 hours. And also, husband works morning shift, like morning 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock till 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock. And then wife works evening or night shift, or either way. And that has big impact upon their children. Just yesterday night after our fellowship, I visited a girl, like 13 years girl. I knew her. I knew their family. father works at, I don't know the company name that they call Hard Box. It's kind of poultry farm, you know?
Oh, chickens, poultry you know? Farm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's so busy there.
Mm-hmm.
I knew her, this girl. She's been, what do you call, we doctor found that she had a problem of hallucination. And we found that the reason is that there's no one to take care of her.
Mm.
The TV is the only means of entertainment or friendship.
The TV is the only.
Mm. Or the computer, mm. or the iPhone, or the phone. It's the only. I visited her several times, talked to parents, but they had no other idea on how to handle,
how to help.
So recently, she was taken to the Pine Rest. So she was there for 10 days, and she's back home. We have been praying.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a small example. You know, children are always overlooked. They are left out with their tablets or computers, and there is no concept of taking them out and in the park or spending time together. There's no weekend, by the way, for them.
There's no weekend. Yeah.
Because weekend has, they earn more money in weekends than throughout the week.
Right. They get a shift premium, and yeah. so they choose to work the weekend because they kind of have to. Yep.
So they prefer to go to work on mm-hmm. the weekend
yep.
just to earn extra money.
Yep.
So there's no weekend
yep.
for them. There's no family time for them.
Yep. Right.
It's very foreign thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they work and their life is here.
Yeah. You know, in a refugee camp, you don't get a formal education. Well, you are kind of supposed to. The UN is supposed to provide it, but that doesn't always happen, or the host country is supposed to provide it. You're almost certainly not getting a secondary college education, right? And so you're coming, as you said, with low education, low skill sets. Maybe you've been born in a refugee camp. And in refugee camps, guess what? It's not like, hey, you can go over to X Street and learn how this skill, and then you can go over here if you want to and become an apprentice. There's none of that. So you come here, there are very few options available to you about where you can work. They're generally very difficult, lot of hours, very strenuous. And because you kind of have to make everything meet, because you're making such a low hourly wage, you work Saturdays and Sundays if the option's available to you. Yeah.
I think also, since they are very less, and also it's culturally appropriate for us, we survive because we all live together.
Right.
One family, you know, one house, there will be three families. And then...
And this is out of,
Six, seven kids sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So they still do share their houses.
Right. They're not bamboo anymore, but they, and that's a matter of survival,
yeah.
You're saying.
Anyways, it's a matter of survival,
yeah.
Yes. And that's how they survive.
That's how they afford to make it, yep. So what's one thing you would say to us if you were to say, hey, Branch, here's a way that you could love, care for, support, the people of the Nepali-speaking community?
I think being a friend is, I think, is the best way that you can show your love or support. We are people. Our people are, by nature, it's not like they will go and introduce themselves. Well, there are very few, but most of them are like, it's maybe because of language or anything else, they will kind of wait someone's to come and introduce. But once that happens, I mean, Nepali people are the most friendliest people.
Mm-hmm.
They are the most easygoing people, that's what I say. So one of the best things that I think people here in the branch or anyone can do is being a friend.
Mm-hmm.
But being a friend with Nepali people is not that easy because people are highly relational. Even as a pastor, if I visit, I have to stay in their house at least for an hour or two.
Right.
I cannot simply go and say, okay, I'm going to work this thing.
Yep.
I just have I came to do some paperwork and I'll go. If I do that, that's kind of rude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
they will prepare tea, and then I have to sit there and drink that tea, finish that tea, and then have some conversation to come out. So it takes 1.5 hours. I said I'll take go for half an hour, but it takes 1.5 hours. That's how they are. So they expect me to sit their house, talk, have coffee or tea, and then we'll leave, you know, the relation. So I think there are many ways that, you know, I think brands can be a friend to our people, especially in terms of like mentoring or even discipling. I know there is language barrier, but once you are very close, language will, the barrier of the wall of language will fall down.
That's right.
If there is really a good connection or relationship. That's what I believe. One of the ways and best way I think for me is that I think you guys can be afraid to our people. They're very open and they're home. You know, many of them are home, like women or children or young people. They're always welcome. They will never say no to a stranger. That is a good thing. You know? Mm-hmm. And that's why some of the Jehovah Witness, they are finding Nepali community is the most accessible and most
interesting
group people.
Because you know, they'll let them into their house, yeah.
Because we, by nature, we can't say no. That's how we are. You know?
We're good at that as Americans. No, you may not come in, but you guys will say, yeah, come on in. We'd love to.
Even if we don't want, we say no.
I'm right.
That's how we spend time with the families, being a family friend.
Yeah.
Or even mentoring some of the youth, they're having a hard time in schools, high schools.
Yep.
There are so many youth in our community, their parents kind of not functioning well in relationship or in the work, and children are left out. And church is the only community they feel they belong. So I could give many examples of that. We have a brother whose mother kind of left him, and father got another wife. He tells me again and again, I find the church, the community, is the only place where I belong. And he's involved in the church so much now, in the worship, in the children ministry, in the youth, and he's going to college now. I mean, that's significant for us.
It is significant, yep. I think this surprised me when you told me, because we've been talking, Rodrigo, Yaakov, and I, about like, well, how do we build relationship together? You know, how do we become more than just three separate congregations in one building? And we've worshiped together, and I think that was great. We all said, and we're going to do it again at the end of March, Palm Sunday. You can kind of put that in your calendar mentally. But worshiping together only gets you so far. Right? I mean, it's a limited time, a lot of people, especially when three churches get together, it's a little chaotic. So that is not the place where relationship is going to form. And so we've been talking like, well, where could we do that? How does that happen? And I'm thinking, hey, Yaakov, why don't you let some of your people know that there's a missional community that meets at my house on Thursday evenings, and they could come and we could help them sort their mail and teach them English and just build relationship with them. And he said, well, yeah, but they're probably not going to come to your house until you've been to theirs. And that's just like, there are lots of reasons for that. But I think what I heard from you in a couple of different ways is that as the host, which we are, if you think about it in that way, we're the Americans, this is our country, as the host, it's our responsibility to take the first step and to extend a hand of hospitality, which might mean going to their house, having tea, and staying for 90 minutes, right? And then maybe they might accept an invitation to come to ours.
Yes.
So I know that for some of you, that feels daunting, completely overwhelming, maybe even out of the question. And so that's not going to work for everyone. But I think it is a conversation Yaakov, Rodrigo, and I are having about how could we maybe help facilitate that if there are people at the branch, at CCGR, at the Nepali Church who would be open to that. Are there ways for us to kind of help facilitate that to happen? So if someone at the branch said, yeah, I'd go sit at the home of a Nepali person and have tea, then we maybe would help find a way to make that happen. So that's a conversation we're having, and I hope that we'll have some more to share about that in the coming weeks. All right, I want to pivot because we've got a few minutes left, and I want to talk about something that you and your church have been working on in partnership with other churches and with other mission agencies. And in fact, we got a little handout I'm going to kind of walk around as you get started and pass out to our people. But Jabit Asha is a nonprofit organization that's trying to do some work in Nepal. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about it? Yeah?
Yes, this is a nonprofit that we have been praying, and we started to start churches back in Nepal. Nepal is still a Hindu-dominated country where 81% are still Hindus. Our government says that 1.4% are only Christians, though we Christians say that we are more than 2%, but government still says that 2012 census says that only 1.4% are Christians in Nepal. But Nepal is such an open country for many ways, for the gospel. Nepal has been in darkness, in Hindus' domination for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. But the door was opened just recently. Protestant history of Nepal is not that old in Nepal, just 60 years.
Christianity is 60 years old in Nepal.
Like Protestant history in Nepal. So it's very young, but it's growing very fast. But people are still, there are so many group of people, like at least 125 language. So that means there could be still many small group of people. And many are still unreached group of people.
I don't want to interrupt, but just like Nepal is not a large country.
Not a large country.
But it sits on the Himalayas are on the northern part of the country. And so that means that there are these little villages tucked away in valleys.
Yes.
And that's how you get 125 different ethnic groups, right?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Okay.
Yeah, villages are like in the pockets of mountains, you know.
Yep.
So one village to another is maybe 1 hour walk or 2 or 3 hours walk. sometime closer. That's how our Nepal is. And it's also strategically it's between India and China. So it's small, but it can play a vital role. For example, many missionaries are going to Tibet from Nepal now. That's how important it is. It's small, but Tibet is a closed country, you know.
Yeah.
It's strictly observed or supervised from the Chinese government, but Nepali people still go there and share the gospel. That's how strategic it is. And south is India, and there's always link between Indian people and Nepali people. And then southern border is the place where it is least reached, actually. Southern border between India and Nepal is the least reached because Hinduism, because of influence of India. So I prayed and we prayed this for a long time. My dad is a church plant for a long time. He has been gone through lots of persecutions, lots of things. When I came here, I always prayed, Lord, how are you going to use me? I never forgot my country, so we prayed, and then that's how God actually opened this door to partner with some of the churches, like Harvard Churches, Pastor Tom, and myself. We prayed, and then we said, I think we should start this some kind of work. That's how Jibit Asa actually was born.
Yeah, so you, your dad's still in Nepal, still planting churches. One of the first Christians in Nepal, right?
Yes, of that area. Of that western part of Nepal, he's one of the old and one of the pioneers.
Yeah. So you, some other American churches, some mission agencies, and then you have people in Nepal and India who are part of a board over there for this organization. Anyway, it's a network is my point. It's a network of people coming together to provide education, training to leaders and to plant churches in Nepal, right? Yeah.
Our main goal is to plant church, no matter what we do. Church planting is my heart and our heart. I know there are so many good things we can do, but I strongly believe deep down in my heart, it is through the church planting people's lives can change. That's what. And then we do other things like education. We have been talking with Mission India. They call it Rewrite. They have good work in India, and they have translated their methods into Nepali. So I talked last time over the Skype. This February 22, I'm going to talk again with the lady, the director of that organization. We have a meeting. So we have been talking how we can bring that adult literacy things in our church planters circle and use that as a tool to reach the undis group village. So we want to train our church planter with their training and send them to their undis village where they can go. We can take, he can take that adult literacy as a means to plant the church.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, equip the people.
Yep.
So we want to do that. So and training, and definitely we want to see that all this effort will lead to church planting.
Okay. So you have some goals. I mean, there's some details on that sheet that we just handed out. Maybe like 4 or 5 months ago, you came to us and said, hey, would you partner with us? And this was right about the time when we were trying to do some discernment around, is there a global partner for us to work with? We were also thinking about and looking for a local partner around mission. And so we're in this process, the stewards are trying to think and pray, and then Yaakov comes. I was like, huh, that's interesting. And so we prayed about it some more, and then he came to one of our meetings and talked with us for a while. And we decided, the stewards decided, that we would partner with this organization in 2018. And what we've committed to is to give $2,100, which is not a lot of money, to be real honest, you know, in the scheme of things. However, in Nepal, $2,100 goes a long way. What it allows to have happen is for a church to get planted and a church planter to be supported. Now, here in America, to plant a church and to support a church planter for a year generally takes more than $2,100, right? But the way that churches get planted in Nepal, and if we had more time, it'd be really cool to talk about that. We don't, so just trust me that in Nepal, church planting looks nothing like it looks here.
Yeah.
Nothing. And so the way that this all happens is different, and $2,100 allows us to plant a church. The idea of the branch planting a church is like bizarre to me because I always think in American terms, you know, and there's no way it could ever happen. And now here, we get to be a part of it. We have $1,500 in our budget dedicated to a global mission partner, and we're going to give that to Jabit Asha. That still leaves us $600 short if you're doing the math. And so here's a challenge I'll offer to you. If every person at the branch over the 6 weeks of Lent gave $1 a week, this would have to involve kiddos too, but we'd close that $600 gap. So $1 a week per person for the 6 weeks of Lent. What would that be like? Could you do that? I bet we probably could. Most of us could. Maybe some of us could do more. But that's the challenge we're going to extend to the branch in the hopes that when we get to Easter, we get to write the full check for $2,100. All right? That's where we're headed here. You want to say anything else as we close?
When I say when you partner with planting church in Nepal, the way I see is it's not simply you guys giving us money. It's not simply you are giver and we are receiver or people that are receiver. I want to see a little bit more closer way. That's what I have been telling. When you are when the branch supports a church planter, that particular church planter becomes more like branch church planter.
Yeah, that's what
I want to see that, yeah. And that's what I'm heading for. I want to see that closer connection. So we will be kind of bridge to that, like church planter and the branch and how things are going. So it's more like relationship, and at the same time, you guys are literally kind of helping that church planter to plant another church, and we want to see that. So it's not like we are receiving lots of fund for one church plant, but rather I'm really dedicated that we are receiving from one partner or from one agency to one church planter, so that there is a closer connection. There is fruitfulness is always, you can own, like I can own, you know, grass can own,
yeah.
Okay, we have done this one, and you can see, all the people here can see that your investment is really bearing fruit.
Yeah.
So,
thanks for saying that. Yeah, that's important to say. Yep. And I think really the goal here is that this person would become like family. We would know who they are. We'd know their story. We'd get updates from them. They'd become kind of a part of us and the work that we're doing. They would just be doing it halfway around the world. So, good.
And beside branch, if there's any individual who would like to, you know,
that's right. Good for you.
There are other many ways to get involved in our local church, in Nepali community, being a friend, being a mentor, being a disciple maker. You can always get involved if you're interested in that, like you want to know more people, our people, be a friend. Please let me know, I'm always willing to help you guys and get that connection. And also if there is anyone interested, like involving Jivit Asha itself, I always welcome. There are many ways to get involved and be a blessing. I always find that our small amount in this country can be a big help to those people back in Nepal or any other country. And that's what we realize, and I teach that to my son, and I have a small piggy bank, and I say, okay, this is for our people. And he knows that when I put some coins, or he knows that this is what Nepal is. Mm. So I encourage that. And yeah. Thank you. Mm.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. Glad to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much. I'm really grateful. Thank you so much for allowing me to come and speak about our church and ministry in Nepal.
Glad to do it. We've talked about maybe having some people from your congregation maybe come in the coming weeks and just give some of their testimony, for maybe 5-6 minutes, so we get to hear some stories too. So we'll be working on that in the coming weeks. Good. We're going to share communion together, and a couple weeks ago when Rodrigo was here, Nate and Rodrigo served it, and they served it as they